Good morning and good afternoon, depending on where you are in our fine land. Thanks for joining us today and welcome to eLearning with E2R. Our topic today is So You Have a Life Outside of Work, a discussion on family status discrimination, which arguably, if you had to sort of chart out where the legal issues are going and where they rank, this arguably in the human resources employment sphere is number or fast becoming number one. By way of housekeeping, we remind those of you who are attending the live webinar that we encourage you to ask questions via the chat box at the bottom right-hand side of your screen, as we are unable to use the raise hand function. We will make the best effort to answer all questions which are asked. However, if we are unable to answer your question over the course of this webinar, an E2R team member will be in touch with you shortly to set up a time for you to speak with an advisor. In addition, we remind all listeners that all of our previous topics can be heard directly by visiting our online resource center at e2rsolutions.com. Lastly, we take this opportunity to remind all of you that the information contained within our webinars is by way of overview only and not intended as a specific analysis of the given fact situation, and accordingly should not be relied upon as legal advice. As always, contact us for any specific questions related to the information in this webinar or any other topic, and for specific applicability of this topic area to your workplace. Our next e-learning with E2R will take place on April 29th on the topic of employee engagement, which of course is a topic filled with a lot of goodies and something that we all need to pay great attention to because at the end of the day, that's really what human capital management is largely all about. So now, without further ado, let's begin. And by way of introduction, once again, I'm very pleased to have Aaron here with me today. So the two of us are going to go back and forth on this topic, and on a few cases, we're actually going to each take, one's going to take the employer position, one's going to take the employee position, and we're going to argue, and we'll see if you guys can come up with what the decision was by the adjudicating body. Okay, by way of agenda, what the heck is family status discrimination? So we're going to talk about what that means legally. And of course, not surprisingly, there is a legal test attached to family status discrimination, and we'll review that. What type of requests may trigger an employer's accommodation obligation? A very, very key question that we will address in looking at some of the cases as to what type of request necessarily gives rise to a consideration of the employer obligation to accommodate. What does this mean for employers? How does this affect employer operations? All part of our discussion today. And then what types of questions may employers ask in light of this obligation that employers face based on family status discrimination?
All right. So as Stuart said, what exactly is this nebulous concept known as family status discrimination? Well, for the most part, it means being in a parent-child relationship. And this not only means the employee taking care of a child, but could also mean the employee taking care of their own parent. So in addition to that, it can be beyond any sort of blood ties or adoption ties, but is based primarily on the care, responsibility, and commitment of the parent to the child and the child to the parent, so on and so forth. Now, while this definition is very clear in jurisdictions such as Ontario, please note that the BC Human Rights Code does not provide for a definition of the term, and instead, the tribunal has said that the definition will evolve and change with societal understandings and perception of what constitutes a family. So potentially down the road, this could mean for a further expansion in the BC jurisdiction to maybe even things like taking care of siblings, taking care of aunts and uncles if you're in that sort of really close care, responsibility, commitment relationship. So as I said, it usually relates to the needs of a caregiver. So in this case, the employee is providing care to either their child or their aging parent. And typically, this causes a conflict for them when they're dealing with certain things that their employer sets out, such as employer work schedules, company policies, and company benefits. Because caregivers are more likely to be absent from work, use company benefits, and turn down promotions. These employees are also most likely to experience a drop in productivity and decline in the number of hours they can dedicate to work as a result of their care and responsibility. As such, can create conflict between the employee and the employer.
So if what we have here, as Aaron mentions, and typically what you see, is a scheduling obligation that the employer has in effect implemented or imposed on the employees, and the employees likely voluntarily have all agreed to it without any issue whatsoever, but then an employee has a family status issue where they're saying, I have to care for my parent or my child or both, and I need the employer to do something to permit me to more easily carry out that family obligation. So, not surprisingly, when you consider it from that perspective, the number of family status claims are rising and are likely to continue to rise due to the sandwich generation. And we probably heard that mentioned in the media in the past, where individuals are responsible for taking care of their children as well as older family members, hence the reference to sandwich generation. More boomers and Generation Xers are falling into the sandwich generation as they've delayed parenthood and their parents are living longer. So what does that mean? You've got kids, you've got elder parents, and now you've got to take care of both. And this next point is actually pretty interesting too. With smaller family sizes, there are now fewer family members to share the responsibilities of caring for an elderly family member. We probably all heard via our grandparents and great uncles and great aunts about how it was in yesteryear, that there were large families living close together and extended families living close together, and that permitted a sharing of family responsibilities. And of course, with smaller families, that's not available as it formerly was. 1/5 of working professionals in Canada fall within this definition. It's a big number, and it's not just women who fall into this category. Men are increasingly likely to be caught in this category as well. The stats show 20% of employed women and 17% of employed men. So this is a big chunk of the workforce that's impacted as part of this sandwich generation.
So the legal test, otherwise known as what are we going to have to go through, what would a tribunal make an employer go through in the event that this sort of claim comes to them? The way that we think it's easiest to think about this is in two simple points. So first, has the employer committed an act that on its face constitutes discrimination? If the answer to number one above is yes, then we look at what are the employer's accommodation obligations. So Stuart's going to explain that a little bit further here.
Okay. All right, so bear with us here. It gets a little legalese, but it's important to appreciate and understand where the human rights tribunals, courts, arbitration boards, are going with this. So the employee first has to say, one, of course, I feel I'm discriminated against on the basis of family status. And then the employee has to demonstrate on its face, so right up front, that there's something there that is real. Okay, now when we talk about adjudicating bodies, of course, it's not that simple. They now look at specific tests. So the tests that have sort of developed recently, when we talk about on its face discrimination, the tests are serious interference. In other words, a term or condition of employment imposed by the employer, which results in a serious interference with a substantial parental or other family duty or obligation. What this has essentially been interpreted to mean is, let's say the schedules are what they are right now, 9 to 5, 9 to 5, 9 to 5. The employer has to change the schedule to 8 to 4. Right? Changes the schedule, bona fide, legitimate business reason, changes the schedule. So now when you look at that, does that change in schedule for example, a sandwich generation person, does that end up resulting in a serious interference with that obligation of either elder care or child care? Right? This is the highest sort of preliminary threshold test. Is there a serious interference as a result, effectively, of an employer changing the current, let's call it, status quo? All right, that's one test. What's the other test? The other test is adverse impact. Simply means a term or condition of employment that the employer has implemented that results in simply an adverse impact on the employee. No serious interference with a substantial parental or other family duty or obligation, just an adverse impact. That is the test that's used in all the other prohibited grounds of discrimination. In order to demonstrate, as an employee making my claim, I have to, on its face, demonstrate that an adverse impact occurred to me, and we're going to stick with child care or elder care for the moment, either based on elder care responsibility or child care, that results from this policy, rule, schedule, whatever it is that the employer is implementing. All right? Because it can change from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, we encourage you, as of course with everything in this discussion today, to contact us. And from you'll notice the bottom point, from the Ontario Human Rights Tribunal's perspective and the Federal Canadian Human Rights Tribunal's perspective, they say unequivocally there's no basis for establishing the higher test. In other words, that serious interference I just talked about, forget it, if it's Ontario or federal. All they have said very clearly to date is that if it just has an adverse impact, then boom, that on its face test is established. And sort of step number one, the employee is satisfied. All right, so next, let's now look at how this has played out a little in a couple of decisions. So in Ontario, and we're going to talk about Devaney and ZRV, a very interesting case. Aaron and I are going to go at it, at each other here, arguing with each other as to how that should play out. So in that decision, the employee must establish whether the employer's policy causes an adverse impact on the employee. By the way, just give you a little insight on what we will be talking about with that case, it's about a policy that says you basically can't work from home. All right? And he's got to take care of his grandma. Well, it's not grandma, it's his mother. All right? Does that create an adverse impact? When you say you can't work from home, you live with your mother requires care. Okay, some interesting points out of that decision. But if the caregiver's personal preferences are in play, then that doesn't meet the case of on its face family status discrimination. We're going to talk about that in some really interesting scenarios as well. But bear that in mind, sort of play that around the back of your head as we go forward with this. If it's a personal preference, well, that's not going to meet that test of on its face. All right, so the code requires the accommodation of code-related needs, not preferences. All right, the federal. This is probably the preeminent decision as of now governing this area, family status discrimination, because it went all the way up to the Court of Appeal. All right, and this governed federally regulated employers. So what's the bottom line? The bottom line in that case is they determined the test for on-its-face discrimination to be as follows. One, this is with respect to child care, that a child is under his or her care and supervision. Probably easy test to meet for most employees who are having an issue with the employer's response to their request. Two, that the child care obligation is in essence a legal duty and not one that relates to a personal choice. Soccer practice, piano lessons, not a legal duty, but you have a legal duty to ensure your child who's 6 years old is not home alone. Clearly, that's actually a breach of, I'm not sure exactly what the legislation is, but it's a breach of legislation if you leave your six-year-old child at home. So that's a legal obligation. So two is going to be met in a lot of cases, although that issue of soccer practice or piano lessons will certainly come into play. That he or she has made reasonable efforts to accommodate the requirements for child care. That is a big one that we are going to be talking about. In other words, if I come forward as an employee and I say, employer, do this for me, please, because of my child care. But what have I done personally to look into the opportunity for me to accommodate my own issue? And then four, that the workplace rule substantially interferes with the child care obligation. It's got to substantially interfere, not just a little. It must substantially interfere in order to trigger this on-its-face requirement. And we won't go into detail on that last point, but BC, just to underscore the point, is still on a different test than what we just went through here on this page, right? So make sure you're talking to us, depending on which jurisdiction you're in.
So if you've gone through what Stuart has just lined out, and the bottom line is, on its face, that the act or policy or standard in the workplace can constitute discrimination, then what happens is that the onus then shifts to the employer to establish that it has accommodated the employee up to undue hardship, and if not, the employer will be found against it by the tribunal or board or court, whichever you're in front of. So the bottom line about having to accommodate an employee up to undue hardship means that the rule or standard in place by the employer must be inclusive and must accommodate individual differences. What we're really worried about here is the hard line rules that are inflexible, that doesn't allow for some flexibility to accommodate for these individual differences. Now, because of individual differences, that means that each employee must be assessed individually. Each accommodation is going to be dependent upon the particular employee and the particular circumstances that the employee is facing. And the most important thing that we have to underscore for employers is that undue hardship requires the employer to tolerate significantly more than inconvenience. The employer typically has to demonstrate through supporting financial documentation that it will incur significant costs to accommodate the employee. And in most cases, particularly when we're coming into scheduling conflicts, it is highly unlikely that we will reach that standard that the tribunal needs in order to meet undue hardship.
Okay, so remember where we're at, right? If test number one is satisfied, in other words, whether it's the adverse impact test or serious interference or all those four that we saw with that Court of Appeal decision, the bottom line is step one is, on its face, is it considered discriminatory? If that test is passed, looking at it from the employee's perspective, then we're looking at the second part of this, which is, now, employer, have you accommodated up to undue hardship? And Aaron just started that discussion about what it's going to take to demonstrate to a tribunal, for example, that you as the employer have undertaken appropriate measures up to the point of undue hardship to you, the employer. Some additional factors to consider when we're talking about that accommodation obligation, right? And of course, these are non-exhaustive factors. Whether the company has investigated alternative approaches. right? One of the first questions a tribunal is going to be interested in is if you're imposing this obligation on an employee, well, surely, right, if it's creating a significant problem for the employee, have you considered alternatives? Right? Because that's your obligation to demonstrate to a tribunal you reasonably accommodated up to undue hardship to you. So have you considered alternatives? Do you have legitimate reasons why viable alternatives were not implemented? Well, why didn't you do it? Why didn't you change the schedule for her? What's the problem? Why couldn't you? Could you have at least done it for a temporary? Acquiesce to that request. Why not? You have to be able to demonstrate whether the standard is properly designed to ensure the desired qualification is met without placing on undue hardship, right, on those to whom it applies. In other words, could we have designed it another way, right? You have to show. You have to be able to show, right? And then for purposes of this presentation today, the last one on this segment, whether the employee has cooperated through participation in the accommodation process, right? That is a very important component. An employee has to cooperate through participation in the process. If the employee is stonewalling and saying, I'm not answering, that's not going to be good enough. So often you'll hear our strategy when we talk to you folks about these types of issues is we need to get the employee involved, and if that employee appears unwilling, we use that in support of our position that there's not a whole lot else we can do.
So let's now take a moment to step away from all the legal tests and the legal mumbo-jumbo and apply it. Let's talk about basic fact scenarios that any employer could potentially face, and then Stuart and I will duke it out. Stuart's going to take the side of the employee, and I'm going to be the big bad employer, and we're going to figure out who's in the right. So Stuart, take this situation, the hockey mom. So the employee is a teaching assistant working with special needs children. She has a very good performance record and has worked for the employer for 6 years. However, this employee has a 14-year-old son who's a type 1 diabetic, but at the same time a competitive hockey player. As with diabetics, it's critical that the level of his blood sugar is well monitored, especially during exercise, as a change in his diet or exercise can cause his blood sugar to decline to the point where he could go into convulsions or seizures, leading to a coma and possibly death. So obviously as a mom, you're going to be concerned here if your employee is a competitive hockey, if your son's a competitive hockey player and a diabetic. So, this particular employee requests 2 days unpaid leave from her employer to attend her son's championship hockey tournament located 4 hours away. However, the employer has a policy that all teaching assistants are required to be at work for the academic year, and any holidays and vacations are to be scheduled during school breaks. In accordance with this policy, the employer denies the request, but the employee takes the 2 days off anyways because she views it as being so crucial to her son's health that she must attend. The employer then subsequently terminates her employment. So, Stuart, tell me why you, as the employee, think you're in the right.
Your Honor, I'll put it in the context of the way you see it on the slide. While her son is old enough, sure, he's old enough to monitor his blood sugars and inject insulin. Let's face it, he is a teenager. A teenager. I don't think I have to repeat that again, and everybody knows exactly what I'm talking about. He does not always make good decisions about food choices and I'm sure other things, but certainly food choices. He likely makes, in fact, very poor decisions and is not very compliant with his finger pokes. Did I say he was a teenager? He's a teenager. Within a short period of time, a diabetic can go from normal function to being unable to make proper judgment. So we started with a teenager who in all likelihood is going to make very poor judgments. We moved to a situation where physically it's a strong likelihood that he can go from normal function to being unable to make any proper judgment whatsoever. A serious situation. It's important to react immediately when a diabetic is suffering from low blood sugars, as the continued drop in blood sugars can progress to a state of seizures, coma, and eventually death. I'm sure my learned friend Aaron is going to mention that while there are three coaches and a team trainer, what do they know what to look for? How are they specifically trained to deal with diabetes and her son's specific reaction and his history as a diabetic and his requirements? They clearly would not be in a position to act in a timely fashion. And why should they be, why should we place that kind of obligation on people that are volunteering their time to coach and train for minor league hockey? Seems hardly appropriate. Bottom line is, her son's safe participation in a very significant activity for a teenager in Canada is to play hockey. And in order to play hockey and participate in what is a widely participated activity by teenagers, she needs to be there throughout the event. She's the primary caregiver. The husband, her husband, is too busy at work, cannot attend. She simply has to be there. And not only does she have to be there during the tournament, she has to travel with the team to be there for the first game because she has a history. When she drives herself, in fact, of falling asleep at the wheel, and it happened to her many years ago, she needs to get on the bus. She needs to be with her son. She needs to participate with her son in what is a very, very basic and fundamental activity to his life, playing hockey in a tournament.
Stuart, I hear you. Definitely hear you. I appreciate hockey as much as the next Canadian does walking down the street. But the bottom line is that this is a request to attend a recreational activity. This is not a medical appointment. This is no way, shape, or form actually related to the care of his diabetes, and it should not take precedence over the educational needs of our special needs students. Moreover, we tried to accommodate her. We offered her one full day off, even outside beyond her policy, and not only that, a compressed work day for the other day, which should have allowed her sufficient enough time to leave work early and get to the game on time. Even beyond that, St. John Ambulance personnel are going to be on duty. Plus, as you mentioned, the team has three coaches, a trainer, and a chaperone. Out of all of those adults watching, are you telling me there's not one capable person who can sit there and help monitor the situation? Because not only do you have those three people, you have a 14-year-old who you allow during the school day from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. to take care of his diet, finger points, and requirements throughout the day. He does this on a consistent basis. You can't tell me, if you can't trust him between 8 a.m. and 5 p.m. every other day, why is this situation different? Not only that, as far as I'm aware, he currently attends hockey practices by himself. He's used to this. He should know what to look out for. So, I mean, you know, in the end, I appreciate it, but listen, we have a number of employees who are underneath the impression that time can be taken off work for whatever purpose they consider valid. I understand that she considers this purpose valid, but it's a recreational activity, and you cannot convince me of otherwise.
The decision. Stu loses. It was found in... appropriately so, that this was not discrimination on the basis of family status. And this was based on the substantial interference test in the sense that, look, at the end of the day, this attendance at the hockey tournament is not essential to the son's well-being, right? Factually, as you heard in some of the argument here before you, that the son was able to administer finger pokes and determine the level of his blood sugars. By the way, he's been playing hockey for a long time and doing this, and the mom wasn't there for every practice and every game, right? And so the parents have trusted him to monitor the blood sugars throughout the school day as well. So on the fact, it seemed like the child was very capable of managing his own situation. But at the end of the day, you really end up in a situation where this really is about that preference, right? It's not about something that's so essential to the son's well-being. And in fact, what the tribunal states, and I'll just read it, is, however, Troy's participation in hockey was not necessary or essential for his physical well-being as a diabetic. It is a voluntary recreational activity. Troy could have easily selected another athletic activity that would not have conflicted with his mother's work schedule or her perceived need to attend the tournament in case there was a health issue. On an objective basis, Troy's attendance at the hockey tournament was not essential to his well-being. As the board observed, hockey is a discretionary recreational activity. So you don't get past step one. It's not discrimination on its face. So we don't have to look at accommodation. But let's keep going.
Round two, the virtual employee. In this scenario, we have a senior employee with over 27 years of service to this particular employer, something that is very rare to see nowadays. He's the principal in charge of a large new tower project being constructed in downtown Toronto. He lives with his ailing mother and is her primary caregiver. He had a significant increase in absences due to caring for her as a result of a fall which broke her hip and a subsequent rupture in her quadriceps, which caused her to become completely incapacitated. In addition to this, while he does have a brother, I mean, he is a primary caregiver. His brother's just not able to take the time. And, you know, he also, his mother took care of him when he was growing up and stepped up to the plate when his dad died. That said, though, in this particular case, the employer has a policy in which all employees are expected to be in the office or available at project meetings during core working hours, which is outlined by the employer, and it's fairly reasonable, 9:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. The employee is able to work from home using his notebook computer and his cell phone, and he does always respond to calls and client emails. However, given his increase in his absences, the employer sends two letters to the employee 9 months apart, informing him that while they recognize his absences away from the office and varied work schedule due to personal family problems, they are no longer prepared to tolerate his absences or varied work schedule. The employee does agree to attend his work, but continues to experience some absences. So the employer sends further communications telling him that it's unacceptable and again sets out their expectations. However, regardless of the numerous communications, the employee just doesn't cut it, so the employer terminates the employee for just cause as a result of the failure to attend at work as requested. The employee, though, has just placed his mother in a long-term care facility and as such needs the income to pay for her care and accordingly begs for another chance. The employer then takes this underneath consideration and comes back with an offer of employment on a contract basis. In lieu of salary, he is to be paid an amount for each full day he attends at the office, and any work done outside the office would not be compensated. This is only for a 3-month period with the chance of renewal. This just doesn't cut it for the employee. So the employee rejects the offer and accepts a consulting position with the developer on the tower project, but this position doesn't provide any benefits, and as such, the employee is out of pocket. So tell me, Stuart, tell me how you're going to fight this one.
My client, my learned friend, seems to overlook, is a 27-year committed employee that has been an exemplary performer. So with that as the backdrop, what is my client asking for? My client's not asking that he not undertake his job responsibilities. Not by any stretch of the imagination. All he's asking for is to be permitted to do his work remotely. Why? Not so he can play video games, not so he can nurture a gambling habit, to take care of his elderly mother, who stepped up to the plate to take care of him and his brother when his dad died. His brother helps 2 to 3 times per week, but he's the primary caregiver. Let's go back to the work. That hard employment issue is all about the work. Well, the work's always completed. He's always available via phone and email. Given his ability to work remotely, everything gets done. Everything gets done. We live in a technological age that permits it. So why go back to Neanderthal times and insist that somebody be in the office? Particularly given these circumstances. Hardly seems like a positive HR best practices for the employer. He's not ignoring warnings from the employer. He understands the employer wants him in, but he's responding to various crisis situations with his mother. He's not going to the drugstore to buy an extra box of Kleenex. We are talking about crises that his mother is facing. His employer is placing extreme conditions on him when he's trying to take care of his aging mother who's going through health crises. And when you think of that against the backdrop of 27 years of loyalty, it's shameful. His mother's a very determined person who wants to keep living in her home and did everything that she could to do so. But her health significantly declined. And at that point, my client actually placed her on the crisis list to get into a long-term care facility, telling the employer she's going into a long-term care facility. Obviously, that would free up his time. Surely, an employer should accommodate that request.
Okay, you can't tell me that it wasn't a personal choice to provide care for his mother rather than hiring somebody to provide that care or having her admitted to a long-term care facility sooner than he did. He could have done it a heck of a lot earlier, especially when he knew the employer's requirements. Moreover, it's not just him. He might get his work done, but he has to understand how his lack of attendance is demoralizing to the entire project and to the office as a whole. I mean, goodness knows how many people walk by his office and sees it empty, to the point where people were fighting over it to park their bicycles in because they know he ain't coming in. His project team is suffering from a lack of direct contact and availability on his cell phone doesn't make up for this. It's a team environment. They need to work together, and the best way, very, very best way to do this is to have everyone in the office. Not only this, let's just put this into context and that we know for certain that not all of his absences were related to his mother's care. We know of numerous instances where he's just late due to traffic, or he just comes in because traffic's lighter at certain times. Given this knowledge and his constant changing pattern of excuses, we have the right to be skeptical here and call him out and say, you need to comply with our policy. Because not only this, you have never sought formal accommodation and have never kept us apprised of his mother's health condition. We weren't in the loop. We were never in the loop. Yes, we knew that there was something going on, but we were never told of any formal accommodation that was required by him. And we were in contact with him on multiple occasions in which he could have raised this with us. When he finally informed us of a request that he wanted to work with us, we gave him that contract offer, which we thought was incredibly reasonable. We gave him another shot, even after all that he put us through. So obviously, we accommodated him.
And the winner is Stu gets this one. The company's attendance requirements had an adverse impact. Remember, we're looking at step one. We got to get through step one here. It was held unequivocally that it had an adverse impact on the employee because the absences were required as a result of his caregiving responsibilities to his mother. Step one achieved. The employees terminated based on absences, and a significant portion of those absences were required due to his family circumstances. Remember, family status, elder care, child care. We've got elder care. We've got working from home, the policy that says you can't work from home, as creating an adverse impact for him, which it did. And, of course, they terminated him. Right? There's your act of discrimination. Only a couple of dozen absences from the office could be attributed to taking his mother to medical appointments or providing care for her, but it's not necessary that the employee prove all of the absences counted against him or as a result of his elder care responsibilities. All you have to show in human rights law is effectively a part of what actions are in issue relate to discrimination on the basis of prohibited ground. And here's as well what we have to think. All right, so we get past step one. All right, now the employer has to demonstrate that it accommodated up to undue hardship. All right, well, how do you do that? Not like this employer did, not like ZRV did. Why? The employer failed to meet even the procedural aspect of the duty to accommodate, which essentially means you better at least think about it, how you're going to accommodate. If you don't even go through that process, you don't direct your mind to how you're going to at least think about accommodating, then even if you couldn't have accommodated, right, you'll be seen to failing to meet the procedural part. So they didn't even think about it, right? They simply insisted that he attend at the office as per the employer's policy. They had a duty to consider and explore the options of how to accommodate. And accommodating this employee, so even if they had engaged in a procedural consideration of accommodation, in these circumstances, the tribunal was pretty clear that they would not have established undue hardship. They didn't present any evidence of how the employee's absences created problems for the team or the office, including how it affected morale. My learned friend raises morale, but there's no proof. Generalizations won't cut it with any kind of adjudicative body. The accommodation of the employee required was coming to an end as a result of his mother being accepted into a nursing home. As you recall, I argued and I said, she's going in, she's on the list. So it was about to end. But apparently, the employer didn't find that all that persuasive, a failure to accommodate. And the contract offer was a joke, as far as the tribunal was concerned. It wasn't a form of accommodation.
Okay, round three with a tie going in. Let's see who comes up the winner. So, an employee requests to telework from home full-time Monday through Friday for 1 year following her return from maternity leave after the birth of her third child. The employee specifically makes this request to accommodate her breastfeeding schedule as she wants to continue breastfeeding beyond 1 year due to the health benefits associated with breastfeeding. The employer, though, recently changed its telework policy, and telework is only permitted for employees with extenuating circumstances such as medical accommodations, severe weather conditions, or family emergency. Upon receiving the request, the employer came back and offered her the option of taking an extended leave without pay. The employee, in turn, explored the possibility of finding a daycare close to the office that would have permitted her to maintain her breastfeeding schedule while working physically in the office, but she decides against this option. As a result, the employee and the employer go back and forth and back and forth with suggested solutions. However, eventually, the employee maintains her desire to work from home. The employer proposes the final response as follows. Either A, the employee could work from home 1 day per week and in the office 4 days per week. the employee could go down and work part-time, or C, the employee could continue on a leave without pay until she feels that her nursing is complete. So, Stu, tell me your final argument.
I can't imagine a more important role for a mother to play than to ensure the good health of her child during those formative stages. I mean, maternity leave for a year. Why is there maternity leave for a year? There's maternity leave for a year so that the employee can bond with her child. That's why you have it for that period of time. So if bonding is important, the good health has to be even on a higher ranking than bonding. So if we look at the World Health Organization, it recommends nursing for at least 2 years or more. Breastfeeding promotes health and helps to prevent a number of diseases, along with other physical benefits. So when we talk about child care, well, if we don't protect the child's health at an early stage, that may give rise to health issues down the line and create difficulties for the employee attending at work. This is a proactive, preventative measure that benefits the employer by permitting the employee to take an extended period off to permit her to breastfeed. Her second child experienced many health problems. Breastfeeding her third child longer might prevent these problems from developing with this child. I can't imagine a more logical and responsible response to what happened with her second child. The daycare located closer to work is prohibitively expensive. I mean, it's simply not realistic to expect her to incur that kind of cost when she has an alternative, which is to work from home and breastfeed from home. And of course, going part-time, which is suggested by my friend's client, is hardly satisfactory given that is a significant loss in pay for family-related needs and is simply untenable and unfeasible.
Stuart, I hear you, and as a woman, I think you make some incredibly valid points here. However, the bottom line is that this particular employer has experienced downsizing over the years. So there are just simply fewer employees available to do the work that needs to be performed both in the office and via site visits. To let this woman work from home would create significant hardship based on the small workforce and on the employer's operation. We were trying, but we just don't have the manpower to let her work from home for all 5 days a week. And while I totally understand that the World Health Organization outlined wonderful benefits of breastfeeding, at no point has she suggested that this newest child has any condition, illness, or disease that makes breastfeeding after 1 year a physical or medical necessity as either the sole source of nourishment or as a supplement. It totally appears to be a personal preference. There are certainly other ways in this particular case that we are certain that this newest child could get their nourishment. The bottom line is, as a parent, your obligation is to feed your child. How you do that is up to you, and breastfeeding is an option, but it certainly is not the only option. And if this is truly, truly something that's important to her, and yet she still wishes to continue working, there is a daycare close to the office that has an opening, and she should certainly avail herself those options if she disagrees with the other options that we've outlined to her. And the winner is...
Erin wins again. So Erin ends up taking 2 out of 3, but I'll get her next time. So what was the basis for the decision here in What's Flat versus Treasury Board? The employee did not make out, remember, on its face, a case of discrimination on the basis of family status. So we never had to get to the accommodation issue because on its face, she didn't make it, right? A parent's legal obligation is to nourish his or her child, yes. How a parent does so is a question of choice. There was no evidence of any physical condition or illness that made breastfeeding a necessity. The expensive daycare was an option she could have pursued, and interestingly, what the tribunal says is the fact that she would be working just to cover the cost of daycare alone does not establish that it was not a reasonable alternative. Remember, we were talking about before as part of the consideration in that number three list from that Federal Court of Appeal decision in Johnstone was that are there reasonable alternatives for self-accommodating? Really, that's what it is. We're talking about self-accommodating. Can the employees claiming discrimination on the basis of family status, are there accommodation measures, self-help measures? Well, she had the option of child care. And just because she said it's prohibitively expensive, well, that doesn't necessarily mean that's not a reasonable self-accommodating measure. And the tribunal pointed that out. The employer, now what the tribunal went on to say is, okay, even essentially if we're wrong, that if she can't, if she is successful in arguing that there is discrimination on its face, did the employer accommodate? So the tribunal kind of went further than it even had to, but it decided to explore it nonetheless. And it said that the employer had met its duty to accommodate. The telework policy was adopted in good faith. It was adopted in response to changes in the number of employees. You heard my friend Aaron mention that they were downsizing. So they had fewer employees, significantly fewer actually. And so they couldn't provide her with the kind of accommodation she was looking for. And they did try to accommodate her by discussing other possible accommodations. Aaron went through that list, but she ultimately refused to yield from her original request. What's interesting when Aaron and I talked about this decision here internally is that this went before a board of arbitration. It would be interesting to see what might happen for a human rights tribunal. In other words, sometimes human rights tribunals could be a little bit more, if you'll excuse the pun, accommodating to employees.
So what do these three cases point out to us? Well, first of all, and this is a good thing for employers, not every circumstance related to family status and caregiving will give rise to a duty to accommodate. Generally, where there's a significant conflict between an important caregiving responsibility and an institutional rule, requirement, standard, or factor, a duty to accommodate will arise. Now, we've been saying throughout this presentation, be wary of inflexible work hours and rigid attendance management policies. These are the sorts of policies that are going to stick out and create these problems. In the event that there is a conflict, the employers must accommodate so long as there is no reasonable alternative that is available to the employee, as Stuart just outlined from the previous case that we just went over. The key being the employee seeking accommodation should be expected to make reasonable efforts to first avail themselves of outsourced resources outside before making the request to the employer. Therefore, it's on you, employer, to ensure that the employee has done so. And as such, feel free to ask questions. So, Stuart, what questions may employers ask?
Okay, we're going to have, this is a serious topic, of course, but we're going to have a little bit of fun with it. But it's real. So remember, we're trying to figure out what options are available to the employee. The employee has to participate in this process, and she has to, or he has to, self-accommodate. All right, so we're going through that process. Let's figure out what some of those questions are. Has the employee investigated available child care services in the community? You would ask questions such as, are there daycare facilities in your area? Have you contacted all of them? Right, because you're saying you have to be home or you have to work remotely or you have to be home by a certain time. Well, hold it. There's child care. We all know that exists. Have you looked into it in your area? Has the employee investigated family members or close friends who could provide child care services to meet the parents' needs? Right? So another option, family. Remember we talked about how the family is reduced now, the sandwich generation, et cetera, but Are there family members available? So you can ask questions such as, why hasn't your spouse requested accommodation from his or her employer? Why not? Why is it falling on me as the employer to accommodate when the spouse could ask his or her employer? In other words, why me? I'm asking the question. Why haven't you repaired, and here's where it gets a little bit fun, but real, why haven't you repaired your relationship with your mother-in-law who lives down the street so that she can take care of your child? In other words, she's not talking to her mother-in-law and then saying, well, my mother-in-law can't do it because I don't talk to her. Well, whoa. Why should the employer bear the brunt of your unfortunate issue in respect of your relationship with your mother-in-law? Maybe you should, as part of your self-accommodating, repair that relationship so that she can take care of your child. Is there someone in your neighborhood or building that could take care of your kids? Can your child attend child care with your neighbor's child? If you don't speak to your neighbors, why don't you? Can someone in your family drive your child to child care services in the area?
I say take it one step further and feel free to ask if employees have the financial means to obtain child care services, particularly if they say, listen, child care is too expensive. I can't afford it. So, employer, I mean, while these seem to be a little bit far-fetched, still, totally plausible. Can you show me your financial records, employee, indicating that you cannot afford a nanny? Can you use your line of credit in order to pay for child services? If you don't have a line of credit, can you obtain one? And there are obviously possibly many more. I mean, Stuart and I could probably sit here and think about a million other questions that you can ask. But the bottom line is, feel free to ask questions. However, of an interesting note, the Human Rights Commission has taken the position that employers should not seek the details of private family arrangements. So, for example, why don't you speak with your mother-in-law? Unless there are objective reasons to believe that the accommodation seeker is not acting in good faith. So, for example, when you have the employee who simply says to you, I've investigated all options, none of them are good, and refuses to provide you with any additional details. That's what we're talking about here. However, this position isn't grounded anywhere in the case law. So as far as we're concerned, the more questions you ask, the better position you're in.
So if an employee gets past, you know, jail and gets $200 in our famous game Monopoly, once that employee has established, right, that there's an adverse impact in effect and that he or she has self-accommodated appropriately, and of course it's not a preference, simply a preference, right, then we move to, we have to show undue hardship. We have to show undue hardship. And remember, undue hardship is a very difficult standard to meet. So employers should be very thorough in asking questions to ensure that the employee has tried to self-accommodate. That is really where we need to be. If an employee is coming forward and saying, I need this, or don't do this, don't do that, don't apply this policy, what self-accommodating measures have you considered? Now, of course, if it relates to soccer practice, well, it's a preference. It's not a fundamental need, right? So it won't get past go. It won't pass that on its face test. But if it gets past there, then we're looking at those alternatives that that employee has considered. And so you can't be shy, employer, in asking questions to ensure that he or she is self-accommodated. And if they don't cooperate, and it likely ends there because they have an obligation to cooperate. So by way of conclusion, and of course there's much to conclude in this area and talk about, we've only scratched the surface as you might anticipate, but you have to expect, and we're seeing it without question, an increase in the number of family status requests. Remember, not all these requests related to caregiving responsibilities will give rise to a duty to accommodate, right? I want to go and watch, have my child play in a hockey tournament. And that's with a child who was diabetic. We talked about that one. That's a preference. That's a preference. That's not going to be protected. Where there's a significant conflict between an important caregiving responsibility and a rule, requirement, standard, or factor, generally a duty to accommodate will arise. So you have to anticipate that it could happen. In the event you as the employer receive a request to accommodate, make sure that the employee has availed themselves of all outside resources first. They can't just come to you as step one. You're not step one. You're step 10, maybe, in the process. Analyze, if that's the case, analyze the request to determine the appropriate accommodation. If they have tried to self-accommodate, they really have no choice. They're coming to you. Now you've got to really figure out what the appropriate accommodation is and whether that accommodation constitutes undue hardship to you as the employer. Bearing in mind, that's a difficult test to meet. So with that, we wrap up our presentation on So You Have a Life Outside of Work, a discussion on family status discrimination. As always, if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to connect with us and we can chat with you about it. And once again, by way of reminder, our next e-learning is on April 29th. And the topic will be employee engagement. So thank you all for attending.